Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in business and economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Autumn Semester 2015. Lecture 16, delivered on October 26, 2015. The title of this lecture is Risk and Return.
Today, Risk and Return. This is the beginning of several lectures in chapters 11 and 12. We're in chapter 11 now. We skip a few in the book there. But this is the first in a series of lectures about risk and return, and this sort of gives you the outline of what is coming. Now, I've already introduced quite a bit of this to you in previous lectures, sneaking it in, the greater the risk, the greater the expected return, all of that good stuff. Here's where I formalize that and begin to talk about some of the details of risk and return. First things first about this. Let me give a little formula here. This is kind of a stupid formula, but it's the historical return formula. This is a very simplistic formula that I will upgrade rather soon. Your total return at any given time, let's say T plus 1, your total return would be the dividend that you got somewhere along the way over the price you pay now, plus the difference between what you sell it at minus what you paid for it, divided by what you paid for it now. In other words, the total return is the dividend yield plus the capital gain yield. Nothing big about that. I mean, the formula looks a little bit more complicated than the actual thing itself. Now, this is a little bit not very useful in the sense that this doesn't give any time frame so that you can compare it to other things. Later, I'll show you how to annualize a return. Not hard to, but you might want to annualize any return that you get from, say, this was over a three-year holding period, turning that into its one-year equivalent. Might be worth it so that you can look at different investments and see what their annualized rates of return are over a holding period. But just to show you an example, and I quickly scribbled this down very quick before I got here to class. Let me show you something here. Starbucks, S-Bucks. Now, this is an almost exactly a 1 year that I'm going to do here. Starbucks, 1 year ago, the price 1 year ago, if you had bought it, let's say, at October, I think this is the 28th of 2014. I wrote these numbers down. I think they're right. Pretty sure they're right. 38.53. The price, if exactly a year ago, or as close to a year ago as you can get, I think the 26th and the 27th were like the weekend. That was what you would have paid for it. Now, if you unloaded that right now, I think the price of Starbucks right now, it closed 62.61, something like that. So that difference right there is your capital gain in dollars. That's your capital gain in dollars. Now you notice that's a pretty darn good jump in that, okay? That's your capital gain in dollars. Now, along the way, Starbucks paid What was the dividend they paid? 64-cent dividend. Somewhere during the holding period, Starbucks paid a per-share dividend of 64 cents. I have to pull out my calculator here to do this. Now, this one's convenient because I'm doing exactly a year. Most people wouldn't hold for precisely a year, so you'd have to do maybe a little bit of annualizing or something like that. But the total return for exactly a one-year holding period would be your dividend yield, 64 cents over what you paid for it, $38.53. That's how much you earned in dividend, plus 62.61 minus 38.53 over 38.53. This is your dividend yield. This is your capital gain yield. Big about this. Just plain old arithmetic. Let me crank that out real quick here. And I would strongly encourage you to do it. 64 cents divided by 38.53. 1.661. I'm going to round this off to dollars and cents here, but in my calculator, I want to hold a few more decimal places. But the dividend yield is for over that holding period. Comes out to be $1.66%. A little better than what you get in a savings account right now for a year. And that's fairly well assured that you would get that. Like I said, companies like to try to hold their dividends pretty carefully in place. Now, the capital gain yield would be, I'm going to put over here that was actually 0.016610. Just hold on to a few more decimal places. Now, the capital gain yield would be... $62.61 less $38.53 equals, and then divide that by $38.53. Really? God. 62. That yield comes out, rounded to two decimal places, $62.50, 62.50%, which was actually 0.624968 plus 0.016610. So your total gain on this would come out to be 64.16%. That's your total return, including your capital gain and your dividend, as far as yields are concerned. That's a darn good return. Darn good return. A caution about this, though. A caution. The first caution is that It works like this. Okay. Have you ever bought a lottery ticket? Oh, okay. You're going to be no fun in Vegas at all. Madam, have you ever bought a lottery ticket? Okay. Now, I have. Never won. Watch the numbers, and they are 6, 18, 23, 61. And I think, oh, man, I could have had those numbers. Why didn't I think of those numbers? You see, that's historical retrospect. I can look back and say, man, that was a great return. Was a great return. You didn't do that, but it happened. But that doesn't mean it happened to you. You see, that's one of the problems with looking at these kinds of things. They might drive you crazy. Man, I should have bought. I'll buy Starbucks now. Well, yeah, you can buy it now, but it ain't going to do that now. That's history. What'll happen now will depend upon what happens in the future. And you're just as likely to get an ass bath as you are to make a, that's a technical term, as you are to make a big killing in a stock. We can look back at stocks all the time and say, yeah, man, look at that great return. I'm going to jump on that train. Well, that's when the train goes off the cliff, is when you jump on. It was great back there. Okay? So, keep that in mind when you look at historical returns. It's great. Yeah, man, that was awesome. I'm going to do that. Well, you're not going to do it with that because that already happened. It's in the past. Anyway, this is a little bit misleading. Well, this one isn't because I did it exactly a year. So you have an annual return here. But a lot of times your holding period isn't for a year. It's for less than a year, more than a year. So you're going to have to do a little trick here to be able to work out what it means in annualized terms so that you can compare it to other things. I'll give you a quick little view on it. Show you one. You buy a stock on October 26, 2015 for $28.35. You sell it on October 25, 2018 for $33.16. What is your annualized rate of return? Now, there are two ways to do this. One way is just kind of like a simple way. You take the total return and divide it by 3 years. That's called an arithmetic average return, an arithmetic average. In other words, okay, 33.16 less 28.35 over 28.35. Ending minus beginning over beginning. That always gives you a percent change. You might want to write that down. I usually emphasize that real early in the course. End minus beginning over beginning gives you a percent change. Okay, if I do that, where the heck? Oh, without putting my calculator away. Okay, I would go 33.16 less 28.35. equals divided by 28.35. So your total return, total 3-year return, came out to be 16.97%. If you divide it by 3, that's your average, that's your arithmetic average return. Average arithmetic and annual return would be 16.97 divided by 3 5.6%. That's a simple, quickie, dirty way to do it. It's also not particularly right. Well, it's kind of right, but it's not the best way to do it. The best way to do it, and I've shown you this before, and now I'll go back to it. And it's sometimes called a geometric way. It's called the geometric average. But in finance, we really don't call it that. One of the things I want to warn you about is in the chapter test and the quiz, they ask you for a geometric average. But I swear, I've looked at that chapter three times, and I don't see them call it a use the term geometric average in the text. But they ask it in the quiz and the test. So know what they're talking about. And I'll emphasize this. Before you hit that test, I'll emphasize this a couple of times. But here is a better, more appropriate financial way to find the right number. Annualized rate of return. You would do 33, the ending, over the beginning, to the 1 over the number minus 1. That's the right way to do it. You can even extend this one so that you could use days. Like if I held it for like, let's say, 612 days, just say 612 divided by 365. You can extend it a lot. But anyway, if I do it that way, yep, the calculator went off on me, sure enough. What the heck? Okay, clear it out, 33.16. Whoops, let me clear that out. Open parenthesis. 33.16 divided by 28.35. Close the parentheses. Y to the X. Open parenthesis. 1 divided by 3. Close the parenthesis. Minus 1 equals 5.36%. That's how to do it the finance right way, because it takes into account compounding. 5.36% compounds out over 3 years to 16.97% total. Just know that. I'll bring it up again. I'll do it in the next lecture again, because I want you to get comfortable with this way of calculating annualizations. Rather than doing them the arithmetic way, which is easier, but it also is kind of like asking for trouble because it's not exactly telling you what really happened.
Was that what I calculated? Let me make sure that I did that. Yeah, stock. Okay.
Okay, that's return. That's historical return. Again, history is dead. It's just a way of seeing how the performance of a portfolio or a stock has been doing up to now. Or in some cases, you would want to know this for reporting purposes of some kind. Okay, I held this for 3 years. This was what my gain was on it. But that doesn't mean that it's going to repeat itself in the future. Because if it did, why wouldn't everyone bail into a stock just to get what they knew was the historical performance of it? And that would wipe out the historical performance before you could ever get to it, because there would be so much buying pressure to drive the price up, and then you buy it at a ridiculously high price. Anyway, moving away from return for just a minute, every return has an associated risk. Now, you can take on something nice like like a T-bill. You can invest in those all the time. They are riskless. There's your risk. But you get a really sucky return. All you get is basically a reward for giving up consumption. You don't get any reward for taking risk. If you want to get more of a reward, if you expect a higher reward, you're going to have to bear risk. Now, remember I told you that there are two kinds of risk. There is unsystematic risk and systematic. Unsystematic risk. It's company news, industry performance, stuff like that. That is not going to get you any reward. You shouldn't expect it because you can shake it out. Because if you put stocks together in a portfolio, they cancel out each other's risk of this kind. Sometimes this is called diversifiable risk because you can diversify it out. Whoops, let me put it where it belongs. Diversifiable because you can get rid of it. No one's going to give you a reward for what you can get rid of on your own. Systematic. Systematic has to do with the world, the globe, the macroeconomy, the forces that are pushing and pulling on all things at the same time. You, madam, turned into a zombie. I don't care. Double tap. There we go. It's over. But if everyone in the room, everyone in this city, everyone in the nation turns into a zombie, except for, you know, the three of us, then I care. We care. We have to do more than, you know, small things. We have to use nukes. And so the thing of it is that this is non-diversifiable. No matter where I run, there are more of these stupid zombies. With you, you come into class, brains, go Cubs. Okay, I can run away from you. But if everyone is doing that, I can't run away. See, diversifiable risk, you shouldn't expect a reward. Well, I held on to this stock even though the president of the company died, and there were a lot of difficult things. They got a flood hit them on their... Well, you see, you're not going to get a reward for that because you didn't need to take that risk. No one's going to pay you to take that risk. But if it is if it's something that is happening everywhere, that's non-diversifiable. That is what you expect to get a reward for bearing. The truth of the matter is that if you look at a stock, give you a couple. There's a couple in the books. They do a nice job. I wish they would have shown a lot more of them. But they showed you, I think, Google and Microsoft. How much of the total risk, in other words, volatility of the price, was attributable to diversifiable versus non-diversifiable risk? It was. It's amazing how much of Google's price volatility you can get rid of it by just putting it in a portfolio of stocks. Microsoft was not as, there wasn't as much. It was still like almost half of its price volatility was diversifiable risk. But I mean, if you look across stocks, it will just blow you away how much of the day-to-day price volatility is the result of diversifiable risk. Risk that you don't need to have and you're not going to get a reward for bearing it. So there you are. That sets the stage. Portfolio diversification is what you should always be doing. If you buy single stocks, you deserve to have the heart attack that you'll get when you see the price going up and down and up and down every day. Now, I'm going to take that off the table. I'm going to use the word risk in a more generic fashion here for just a little bit. Let me tell you a few things here. I need to bring up one thing. I almost forgot about it. When we look at prices, see these prices that I've written all over the board here and did these returns, these are nominal rates of return. They are the result of you're not correcting for inflation. If you correct for inflation, things don't look as pretty, especially in times where there is a lot of inflation. But even in times when there is not so much inflation, it really is a good idea. It's a really good idea to look at the get rid of the nominal and look at what really happened. I'm going to show you something here, right, very quickly. Back when I was writing about the end of the world that was coming with the Great Recession, I was predicting it. I put up a graph I just showed. You think the stock market's been doing great in the first years of the 21st century? I showed them, I took out the inflation, the nominal, I turned the returns, these are annualized from 2001 to 2006. In other words, I took the beginning and the end, and I took it to the 1/6 power minus one. That's how I got those numbers. You're seeing exactly the process. And I said, look at the real rates of return. Good God, they were all being creamed. The people's portfolios were being businesses, trust funds. I said, any one of these indexes that you would invest in, you lost money. And the riskier the portfolio, the worse it was for you. And it was not being talked about. Everyone had their head in the sand. Well, it doesn't look that bad to me. If you look at the real rates of the nominal rates of return were positive. But when you took out inflation, every one of the major stock market indices was showing negative annualized real rates of return for over the period from 2001, actually early 2002, I should say, from early 2000, no, yeah, it was 2001, sorry about that, early 2001 to 2007. This was one of the last, this was along the way I was saying there's something bad is coming. When stock markets are showing this kind of nastiness, that's not a good sign at all. But, and that was more than a year before the all hell broke loose in 2008. But even at this point, I mean, all you have to do is stop wanting, hoping, and start looking at what really is. And you can see that was not a pleasant scenario that was building. And I was publishing this stuff, and of course I was just a naysayer and a conspiracy theorist. But anyway, let me take that off the board here for just a minute. I'm going to bring up something. Okay, portfolio diversification, stock indices. There are a lot of different ones out there. There's the Dow Jones Industrials. That's 30 big stocks, and they are tracked as if they are a portfolio. In these, they usually assume that any dividends are reinvested in the portfolio. So the gain is a total return gain. Dividend yield is folded into the capital gain yield because as these stocks grow in price, any dividends that are paid, they assume that just is more purchasing into the portfolio. So the big heavies, the Dow Jones, and well, I can. Why don't I just show you this? Look, the big one, Dow Jones Industrials, 30 massive, massive companies. Interestingly, it's not the same 30 that would have been there, say, 20 years ago. There are sometimes they kick out a company that's kind of its industry is going away. They'll put in some new monster company that's on its road to the future. These are big, big, probably the biggest animals comprising a notable part of the entire economy of the country, possibly the world. The Standard & Poor's 500. It is a top-notch 500 big, big companies that are publicly traded. I don't think S&P 500 has any of the same as the Dow Jones. I don't think. I never even thought about that. But anyway, it's big ones. It is your, serious top tier 500 companies. The NASDAQ is more a measure of small companies, smaller. There are some monsters in there too. Don't get me wrong about that. But it's smaller companies. Now the deal is this. Have you ever had a housefly annoy you? Yeah. I mean, it's all over the place. Now, have you ever had a pterodactyl bother you? Okay, well, here's how it works. It goes, Okay? It's not as volatile as the housefly. Now, if you actually smack the housefly, but if you smack the pterodactyl, it's going to look at you. You're probably thinking, yeah, notice how people kind of go fetal. Here's the thing, though. Smaller means it generally tends to be more volatile, more movement in the stock price. Bigger means less movement. It's more lumbering. If you saw the original Ghostbusters movie, did you ever see it? Anyone? Anyone ever saw it? You saw it. Do you remember when the guy, they weren't supposed to think of anything at all because if they thought of it, it would become real? And then that one idiot thought of the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man, and this like 100-foot tall Stay Puft Marshmallow Man starts boom, 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 boom. Okay. Where the hell was I going with that? It's slow moving. It's lumbering. It doesn't have as much volatility in it. And that is true of anything. And also, small events don't have as much impact on big things as they do on small things. That's just, you know, that's an obvious principle of life. And so, when you have a portfolio that is comprises small companies, you should expect more price volatility than you would have in a portfolio that comprises large companies. So, and hence, also, smaller companies will tend to have a more significant component that is non-diversifiable. In other words, a smaller company might tend to have a higher beta than a bigger company would, because its total risk is bigger, and so the part that is not diversifiable, it's systematic, would be more significant as well. Think about it this way. A very large company that's hit with a global recession, it might be staggered some, but it's not going to really be harmed all that much. A small company that in a global recession, I can speak to this, personally, you will just get creamed in a bad recession. When I started my business as a landscape photographer and selling my artwork back in the middle of the 2005, 2006, I everything was good. But man, when that recession hit, I was like, went from maybe $1,000 a show down to $0 in some shows. Just blasted me. Well, I mean, but Walmart was still cruising along. Target was cruising along. The big, huge companies, yeah, they were hurt by it, but they weren't like staggered and knocked to the ground. So small is going to be more volatile. Small will have a greater total risk, and it will also probably have a greater non-diversifiable systematic risk. And you can see that here. See how what was happening was bad. And there's no question, I was saying there's something bad happening in our economy. I have graphs I could show you showing that investment, capital investment was collapsing in the 2001 to 2008 period. So many things were negative. This was one of them. But what you notice here is that it was bad, but the Dow, those massive, ginormous 30 companies, it wasn't as bad for them as it was for the 500 large companies. And it wasn't as bad for them as it was for that giant composite of all the small cap companies that comprise most of the NASDAQ. So there you are. That sets a stage. Now, this is from Fred, your friendly Federal Reserve database. These are the volatility. This is changes, month-to-month changes in the Dow, the Standard & Poor's, and the NASDAQ. First, visually, you can see. Do you see how the price changes from month-to-month in the NASDAQ are the most pronounced? Do you see that, how the green is just whipping up and down? Generally, they're traveling about together. I mean, the same. These are the systematic forces that affect all stocks. So the beta you're looking at with the NASDAQ is larger because it's magnifying the overall market's problems. If you look at the next one, the Standard & Poor's, it's blue. Do you notice you still see more volatility than you do with the Dow Jones? But it's still tracking the Dow Jones. That's that thing I told you about beta. That part that is tracking, everything tracking together, that's that systematic risk. It's in the system. You can't get rid of it. That's what you expect your reward for. If you want a high reward, if you expect a high reward, you go with NASDAQ. You see how the market's volatility is magnified? If you don't want as much of a reward, you want more safety, you'd probably go to maybe the Dow or something like that. Let me show you one more here. I'm going to pull one in here. Add a data set. I don't know. I've never even thought about looking at that. I was going to go with one of the Wilshires. Wilshire 5,000 stocks. And let me fix it up. I want quarterly. I want percent change. There you go. Oh! Hello, Nelly. Look at that. Okay. Wasn't expecting that. You see the Wilshire? That's 5,000 stocks. Now, one thing, if I remember right about the Wilshire, is most of these indices, they are weighted by the market cap of the company. So that bigger companies would have a heavier weight in the index than smaller companies, smaller market caps. Wilshire doesn't do that. Wilshire just takes a straight up average of all 5,000 stocks. So that's a difference that I don't know what that means here, but look at that son of a dog. That's interesting though. That's a rather big whipping boy. Okay. Anyway, take that off the tape. Let me kill that. Let me delete that series, okay? I want that thing gone. Okay. I want that. Make that go away. Seriously. Where? Oh, there it is. Yes, I do. Remove it. Okay. Now, interestingly enough, let me show you something very quickly. And this is important. It's kind of important for a chapter later, but it's also important for you for your investment learning. Do you notice that in these hurricane downs and hurricane ups, quite frequently, they don't just move together. The big and the small all move the same. That's something that's an interesting thing. That your play for playing on volatility, playing on non-diversifiable risk, is a play that is best done in the times of more normal life, more normal economic times. Because in the heavy changes, in the heavy times, you will generally tend to see everything going the same way and at the same speed. You see it there? 2011 quarter three. Actually, even 2011, right before quarter three, quarter two. See that went on 2014, the last quarter of 2014. When you have really strong forces, they lift and throw all size companies kind of together in terms of stock price. So it really, well, I think we're going to have a real downturn, so I better get out of these risky stocks and move over into the Dow Jones 30. Look at that. that probably isn't going to do you a whole hell of a lot of good in a hard downwind. And if you think about it, in life itself, I mean, if you know that Category 4, Category 5 hurricane that came? Okay, you're a vagabond. I am a very important rich person. We're both standing on the hurricane. Okay, guess what's going to happen to us together? Yeah, we're going to die. We're going to be thrown up in the air, and then we're going to be thrown down on the ground, then thrown back up in the air, and you're going to say there's no place like home, and I'm going to say, shut up, I'm not wearing my red shoes today because I left them at the shoe place to be rehealed. Not spikes, pumps, you know. Okay, anyway, the thing, though, is that in that hard wind, it really doesn't make a whole lot of difference where you are in the market. The wind is going to take the stocks together. It's your plays based on risk are in more normal times a lot often. Now, I'm going to give you another indicator here, and I will bring this up again later in the course. The truth of the matter is that once you have formed a well-diversified portfolio, maybe 30 stocks, or you buy mutual funds or ETFs, once you've done that, moving them around too much is one of the stupidest things you can do. Panicking in a downturn is just asking for trouble. In other words, buy and hold is and always has been and always will be your best long-term strategy. Now, you can feel important like day traders do. I'm watching the stock market. I bought myself $1,000 worth of software. I can see a buy signal. You're going to probably just waste your time, waste money on software, and you could have been doing something much better with your life than fretting over what you're going to buy and sell today. There's a dark side to this, though, and it has to do with you, folks. See, in the theory behind finance, we actually understand a lot about what's going on. It comes from the world of physics, high-powered mathematics. I mean, you're talking about things like stochastic partial differential equations, the stuff that literally, I can't do it. We can't do it. We actually have to have computers work out numerical solutions because there aren't algebraic solutions to what we're doing. But underneath it all, we can break down and understand these stock markets in terms of what the long-term average rate of return would be on a portfolio that you buy and hold. Realistically, over a long period of time, historically, one of the key parameters, sort of like one of those forces of nature, like the speed of light, Rydberg's constant, pi. It was called Tobin's Q. It was a parameter, sort of like a constant that was in the formula that determined the driving force to push stocks upward. There is a bias upward. Over a long period of time, the equation told us that about 6 to 7% rate of return on a buy and hold portfolio. You buy and hold a portfolio over a long period of time, you would probably see an annualized rate of return over a long period of time, 6 to 7%. Unfortunately, something strange happened. I didn't quite understand it back in that time. I've already deleted it. I was looking at that graph and I was saying something is really fundamentally wrong. Then I began to read some of the theoretical and empirical work being done by finance researchers, who were beginning to say, Tobin's Q has shifted. It's sort of like saying the speed of light has changed. It's sort of like saying pi has moved. Tobin's Q, we now know it shifted. It did shift. And the shift was to the effect of causing the buy and hold long-term average rate of return to go down. So in my generation, buy that portfolio, build it up over a long 30, 40 years, 7% annualized rate of return. compounded over 30, 40 years, you got yourself a really decent retirement as long as you are putting in money all the time. Just keep buying in at the same balance. Keep your portfolio balanced. It's shifted down now, 4 to 5% for your generation. And there, it looks like it might, there's some prediction that there's another shift coming. Before you even get out into the work world 5 years, Tobin's Q seems to have started to slip. It didn't just do that. It's actually sliding. It's pointing to possibly you having no better return on a buy and hold than 2, 3% over your lifetime of work. In other words, that growth path, the buy and hold, is still the best strategy, but buy and hold is pointing to not nearly as good and a long-term, over a productive lifetime return in your generation as it was in your grandparents or mine. No, yes, I guess your grandparents might be my generation. Anyway, so what does that mean? That means, let me look at something here. Standard & Poor's. I'm going to pull Standard & Poor's. I'm going to get rid of these other ones. Add a data. I think, wait, does Standard & Poor's go back that far? I think Standard & Poor's is the one that sucks. Let me get rid of Standard & Poor's because I think that's the one that's not very good. Remove. And the Dow Jones. I'm going to get rid of the NASDAQ. And we're just going to keep a very safe Dow portfolio. And we're going to run that thing out from January of 1971. Oh, February, okay. First day of it. And what we're going to do is we're going to fix this so that it's just a monthly index. Monthly that's the Dow? Really? Shoot, I wanted one that was better. Let me get rid of that one. Let me add a data series. Let me do Standard & Poor's. Standard S&P 500, there it is. Okay, let me try that one. Okay, add the series. Okay, now monthly index. Well, I guess I'm not going to see. The data doesn't go back very far for these. But as you can see, it does have an upward growth pattern to it. But here's the deal. Here's the other thing. Something that I want to do. Real median household income. Add the series. Annual. Okay. Let's take it back. Oh, Fred doesn't go back very far. Now, this is real up here. It's real annual median income. Now, I want you to notice something. If you take it back to 1960, 1950, you'll see that it has had its ups and downs. But over the long haul, your work is not what's going to give you a growing reward. In real terms, your work is at best a little bit growing, but for the most part, it's remained flat, pretty flat over the years, over a half a century. It has remained relatively flat. So where you are going to earn a growing amount of money would be in the stock markets. But that return over a long period of time in the stock markets is not going to be as good for you as it was for your grandparents or for your parents.
but mostly your grandparents. What that means for you is you got to work your asses off to make a better and better life for yourselves in the years ahead. That's all the good news I have for you today. I thank you.